Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Dr. Greg Cohen, who's on our CME committee, is going to introduce our first speaker, but two other announcements. First, I want to make sure everyone remembers next week is Grand Rounds on coronavirus. So I suspect we will have a very large crowd for that, so try to get here early and on time. Also, the internal medicine course, the end of the month, the last weekend of March, register early because we're actually getting our highest registration number so far, and when we hit a certain limit, we're going to have to close registration. So send in your registration early if you want to go to that course. Anyways, again, this morning, Dr. Cohen is going to introduce our speaker.
Thanks, John. Hi, good morning, everybody. Again, Greg Cohen, for those of you who don't know me, I have the again, the honor and privilege of introducing to you Dr. Roger Blumenthal, who's coming to us from Johns Hopkins. He's the Kenneth J. Poland Professor of Cardiology at the Chicarone Center for Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease, and a national thought leader who's published numerous articles of note, too many to go through, but of most recent note and honor would be co-chair for the 2019 ACC-AHA Cardiovascular Disease Prevention Guidelines, which he's going to tell us something about this morning. So without any further ado, I'll introduce Dr. Blumenthal.
Well, folks, good morning. I guess if I had put coronavirus in my title, then we would have had like a full auditorium. But I'll try to make sure we keep it light and lively. I'm going to talk to you about an easy way to approach maybe every single patient in your practice. And it's all based on Jackson 5. Remember that singing group? They had a song called ABC, Simple as 1, 2, 3. And Michael was sort of my vintage, so I always liked that. I was... Once I told a group of house staff that I was a big fan of Michael, we were contemporaries, and then one of the smart aleck interns asked me if Michael ever asked me to stay over at his house. So I decided I'd better drop that one there. But back in, I guess it was 1999, Ray Gibbons from the Mayo Clinic put together this ABCs of chronic stable angina, and I thought I was just about ready to give a talk to the house staff at Hopkins, how they could remember everything that they needed to know about cardiology. And I thought this would be a cool way, invoke the Jackson 5, Michael Germain, and things of that nature. And that's what I'm going to try to present to you, a good way to remember everything from an internal medicine cardiology standpoint. So we've adapted over the years this ABC approach, where we start with assessment of risk. And we'll talk a lot about that today. Probably the vast majority of us in this room have never had a heart attack or stroke or a cardiac event. We want to keep it that way. Then antiplatelet therapy, aspirin, yes or no, dual antiplatelet therapy, yes or no, anticoagulant therapy, CHADS VAS score, B for blood pressure, C for cholesterols, C for cigarettes, D for diabetes or glucose management, diet, weight, exercise, and education. And I think if you sort of think about this and all your patients, about all the cardiovascular issues, it's a good, easy way to put all these guidelines into perspective. So as Greg mentioned, I had the pleasure of co-chairing with the former president of the American Heart Association, Donna Arnett, these primary prevention guidelines. And a number of the folks bolded had I had worked with a lot, either at Hopkins or through other AHA activities. And while we didn't officially get the ABC approach in the guidelines, I think it's a good way to keep track of everything. So let's start off. We're going to get focused on, Dr. Rubin was real interested in some of the issues about aspirin. I'm sure many of you are, since that was one of the things that made the headlines. But we always start off with the assessment of cardiovascular risk. And keep in mind that the emphasis is on shared decision making. Maybe 10 years ago, if a doctor told a patient, you're eligible for this, you really should take it, and this is why, we didn't always listen to them as much maybe about what their feelings were. But the shared decision-making is so important, and the guidelines also talk about a team-based approach to prevention. utilizing dietitians, nutritionists, pharmacists, people skilled in smoking cessation. And we also emphasize a term that I think a lot of us in the audience probably not too familiar with, called social determinants of health. These socioeconomic factors are so important. And, you know, maybe your typical patient here in Boca Raton doesn't have to worry about some of these things, but you probably have some of the people that do. You know, their housing situation, can they get healthy food? They have trouble with transportation, getting to the doctor's visits. Can they pay the high costs of utilities? Do they have a safe place to work out and to exercise? And I think social determinants of health are becoming more and more an important thing that we all have to remember. So traditionally, when we talked about we talked about assessment of risk. And the guidelines say that if you're middle-aged, 40 to 75, you want to calculate your 10-year risk of ASCVD. So you might say, what is ASCVD? So atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, heart attack, and stroke. The old Framingham guidelines and a risk score was just about heart attack, but adding in stroke I think is really important. A lot of our patients want to know what their risk is of both heart attack and stroke. And we said it's reasonable to assess risk factors every 4 to 5 years, and we should think about these risk-enhancing factors, things like family history, persistently high triglycerides, metabolic syndrome, and we'll come back to that. So the way I like to look at it is that, you know, it doesn't cost anything to do this ASCVD risk score. You measure a blood pressure, get a lipid panel, that's pretty much it. And you can, that's a class 1 indication. And a class 2B indication is a 30-year risk. So if people haven't gotten to the age of 40 yet, then giving them some idea what their 30-year risk is, I think, can be really helpful. Because the ASCVD risk score is dominated by chronologic age, which your birth certificate says. Then we introduce this concept of risk-enhancing factors. And how many in the audience, for curiosity, have ever ordered a coronary artery calcium scan? A fair number. So that's also going up because of the evidence base for that, selective use of that to help us determine who's really at higher risk and who's not. So these risk-enhancing factors, family history, having an LDL persistently above 160, chronic kidney disease, estimated GFR less than 60, metabolic syndrome. For those of the people in the audience who have a special interest in women's cardiovascular disease, we introduced this concept about conditions specific to women, preeclampsia, premature menopause. We also talked about chronic inflammatory conditions, things like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, HIV, lupus. We talked about higher risk ethnicities, South Asian descent, Native Americans. We talked about triglycerides being high. And then if measured, a CRP that was high, a lipoprotein little a that was high. Has anyone ever measured an LP little a, just for curiosity? A few of you. And I think we use that sometimes as sort of a tiebreaker. You can think of half of it's like an LDL particle, half of it's like plasminogen, which is involved in blood clotting. Having a persistently elevated LP little a may double your estimated risk, and it also puts you at a higher risk of aortic valve stenosis, aortic valve calcification. So you might think, well, these risk-enhancing factors, they probably, you know, if you have them, you're definitely at high risk. But in reality, some work that some of our fellows led at Hopkins indicated that you could actually have three of those risk-enhancing factors if you were part of the MESA study, and still about 45% of those people still were at very low risk. They had no coronary artery calcium. So keep in mind that just because you have risk-enhancing factors like metabolic syndrome, chronic kidney disease, high triglycerides, doesn't mean that you necessarily are going to be at high risk. So then the guidelines said, if your decision for giving a statin or aspirin or maybe a blood pressure medicine was still uncertain, consider a coronary artery calcium scan. Now, I'm not sure what they charge here at the hospital or nearby, but in Baltimore and at Hopkins, we charge $75. And I think that's a good way when you're on the fence about what to do to think about that. And we also talked about estimating that 30-year risk can be very helpful. So how do I explain this to our house staff and medical students? Well, I say that the pooled cohort equation, that estimate, gives us a pretty broad range. It's an estimated guess. And maybe more risk-enhancing factors will shift that more to the right. This is a high-risk group, 20% or high or greater. A low-risk group, less than 5% risk of a heart attack or stroke. But if you have at least moderate coronary calcium or a real high percentile for your age, you can rest assured that you're really in that high-risk group. And likewise, if you have no risk-enhancing factors, you sort of shift things to the left, and you know that if you have no coronary calcium, your 10-year risk is extremely low. So that's an easy way, I think, to convey that. So what about aspirin? So probably we had more comments about aspirin or guidelines than anything else. So we actually downgraded aspirin to what we call a 2B indication. We said low-dose aspirin might be considered for primary prevention among select individuals at higher risk, but not at increased bleeding risk. And you might say, well, you know, when I went to medical school or when I was doing my medical training, you know, aspirin was one of the key things. But as I'll show you in a little bit, we have a number of studies that have shown that aspirin's benefit is probably pretty minor in people like the vast majority of us in this room who've never had a cardiac event. We said that low-dose aspirin should not be given routinely to people over the age of 70 because we have a really good trial that we'll talk about called ASPRI. And we said we definitely don't want to give aspirin in people at increased risk of bleeding, and we'll define that in just a little bit. So this may send shivers up and down your spine when you look at these targets for antiplatelet therapy, but all you really need to remember is that aspirin is an inhibitor of COX-1, which halts the production of thromboxane A2 and thus inhibits platelet aggregation. And there's a number of other things that cardiologists routinely prescribe, these P2Y12 inhibitors, and if someone's had a stenting procedure, they get aspirin plus one of those. And then the anticoagulants, of course, come in various flavors, and we think about the NOACs and once-a-day medication. If you watch PGA Golf Tour, NFL football, you'll see lots of ads for things like Eliquis and Xarelto and things like that on TV. So let's get back to what we know that aspirin does well. Secondary prevention means you've already had an event, you're trying to prevent a subsequent one. And this was a large meta-analysis back in 1994. Does anyone remember where they were in 1994? That was a long time ago. And essentially, when you put all those studies together, you had somewhere in that 25-27% relative risk reduction in major cardiac events. But when you get to the lower risk group, you have to balance the vascular events, maybe decreasing them, but they're much lower than your patient who came to Boca Raton with a heart attack and a stent. And you also have to weigh those bleeding complications. And surprisingly, a lot of those aspirin studies, it was a higher risk of GI bleeding than we thought. So this was a nice article published July of 2019. It looked at aspirin use and primary prevention in the U.S., and, you know, about 22% of women, 25% of men were taking aspirin. And for age groups, you can see, especially, you know, once you get to age 60, it was more than a third. And then you get over 40% as you get older. So, you know, we've been ingrained to say, you know, if you're not on aspirin, you're not doing all you can. But in reality, our guidelines sort of change that. And I've always liked this cartoon, and we'll come back to the concept later. It says the doctor tells the patient aspirin a day will help prevent a heart attack if you have it for lunch instead of a cheeseburger. So we know that better dietary and exercise habits work. We're still not sure how effective aspirin is going to be. Now, our prior aspirin guidelines in 97 and 2002 said, you know, aspirin should be used in people at intermediate risk, so a 10-year risk of a heart attack of at least 10%. That was pretty high, and that was mainly older people, people who smoked, had high blood pressure, diabetes. And that was based on older studies. And, again, very high-risk group. It really wasn't for everybody. And then Paul Ritker published this nice analysis back in 2005, where it was pretty clear that aspirin seemed to do a better job of decreasing heart attacks by close to 30% in men, But it was in women, it was about a 20% decrease in stroke. Now, maybe because women tend to have more strokes as their initial manifestation of cardiovascular disease than men do, but we're still not sure, you know, why that is. And we had this 2014 meta-analysis that basically said aspirin decreased major atherosclerotic events by about 10%, but major bleeding went up by about 50%. So we've had a number of these studies for a while that gave us some pause about whether to willy-nilly give aspirin to everybody over the age of 50. In 2014, we had this study from Japan. It was called the Japanese Primary Prevention Trial. They used, as most of the studies did, 100 milligrams of aspirin versus no aspirin, followed for 6.5 years. And to the surprise of many of us, there was really no difference between aspirin and no aspirin. And this was death from cardiovascular causes, as well as non-fatal heart attack and stroke. And more recently, in 2018, we had the first of three really large trials that you need to be aware of. This one was called ARRIVE. Over 12,000 patients followed for 5 years. You needed to be a man at least 55 or woman at least 60. And they thought they'd have an average 10-year risk estimate of close to 20%. But in reality, the observed event rates were actually less than 10%. So the population was at sort of a lower to moderate risk. They excluded the people who they thought were at high risk of bleeding. They also excluded diabetes, and they still used that 100 milligram dose versus placebo. And again, many of us were really surprised, only a 4% decrease in events. And this was the time to first occurrence of cardiovascular death, MI, unstable angina, stroke, or TIA. So again, didn't work. And part of the reason it didn't work is that this time to first GI bleed was about twofold higher in the aspirin group. And some people, as we know, tend to be on a number of medications, whether it's non-steroidals or other things that can irritate the GI tract. And so that was disappointing that in that ARRIVE study, we didn't show a benefit. Now, Boca is known for a lot of snowbirds, and a lot of your patients are 70 years and older. So this was a study that looked at adults in Australia had to be at least 70, or in the U.S., at least 65 if they were black or Hispanic. Almost 20,000 people, if they had cardiovascular disease, dementia, or some sort of disability, they were excluded. They were followed for 5 years. They were randomized to aspirin versus placebo. Half were at least 74, and more than half were women. And what was really surprising in this study is that there was a slightly higher risk of all-cause death. If anything, we thought aspirin would decrease cancer deaths, like GI cancers. But in reality, after about 3 years, it was a higher risk of cancer death in the aspirin group. It was a 30% higher risk of cancer deaths. So that really changed. And maybe if it was a longer-term follow-up, and maybe if aspirin does have effect on decreasing colon cancer, we'd see that later, but we just didn't see it in this study. So one way of looking at it is, if you look at cardiovascular disease, events per 1,000 person years, it was pretty much the same. It was 11. And major hemorrhage was higher in the aspirin group. So again, a big surprise, and that's part of the reason why many of us, if our patients are over age 65 and are really in that primary prevention without significant risk factors, many of us now are telling our patients, oh, you probably can do without the aspirin. So here was another study called JPAD. This was patients with type 2 diabetes, low-dose aspirin. And while there was a trend for a slight benefit in aspirin, it was far from being statistically significant. In another study of people with PAD and diabetes called Popadad, we again didn't see any real difference between aspirin and no aspirin in the composite endpoint or in deaths from cardiovascular disease or stroke. And this one, the average follow-up was about 7 years. Now, you might say, well, how about those diabetics, Roger? I'm sure they're at higher risk. Aspirin's got to help them, right? Well, in reality, this was a study called ASCEND, so you can remember D for diabetes. 15,000 people followed for 7.5 years. Again, 100 milligrams of aspirin versus placebo. Average age 63 in the standard primary outcome. And lo and behold, we saw a modest 12% decrease in events, but that was counterbalanced by an increase in major GI bleeds. So when you look at the effect of aspirin on major GI bleeding, it was about 30% higher. And so if you tell a patient, well, I can maybe lower your risk of a heart attack or stroke by 12%, but you have a 30% higher risk of having a major GI bleed, they'll say, doc, I think I'll pass. So what did we say in our primary prevention guidelines? Well, we talked about, you know, in recent trials, the estimated risk exceeds the actual risk. So the ASCVD risk score in many studies, some of which our group's done, you know, tends to overestimate by a factor of 2. And the committee felt that there was insufficient evidence to recommend a specific risk threshold as an inclusion criteria for aspirin. Though a number of us still say, well, maybe if you have a 20% or higher risk of a heart attack or stroke, you know, you might consider aspirin. And we said a clinician should consider the totality of the evidence. That's a Charlie Hennekin's phrase, and don't think Dr. Hennekin's is here, unfortunately. And we also said, where appropriate, consider risk-enhancing factors. Let's go. Strong family history of early heart attack, inability to get to your lipid, blood pressure, glucose targets, or maybe a high calcium score. Those are the things where you might consider using aspirin. So what are the situations where you say people are at a higher risk of bleeding? Well, maybe if they've had a prior GI bleed or peptic ulcer disease, maybe if they're 70 or older, maybe if they have low platelets or a coagulopathy, maybe if they have chronic kidney disease, maybe people who are on steroids or NSAIDs, et cetera. So those people, we tend to shy away, especially aspirin and primary prevention. So you might say, why are the studies different? Well, compared to prior decades, the more recent populations that we've looked at, there's less smoking, there's greater utilization of statin therapy, and there's better blood pressure control. And the percent taking statin therapy in those big three trials in 2018 were pretty high, ranging from about 34% to 75%. And while aspirin may reduce the incidence of colorectal cancer, we've seen in other studies, the more recent studies didn't show that, though the average follow-up was more in that 5 to 7 years. So aspirin for cancer prevention, it's just null. Doesn't seem, when you look at all the data, doesn't really seem to be helpful. And a recent meta-analysis when looked at CVD prevention, the number needed to treat to prevent one major cardiac event was about 260. The number needed to harm for a major bleed was pretty much the same. So, again, that's why we're aspirin's really going down in our priority list. For those of you really interested in the topic, there was a nice article last year in Annals of Internal Medicine that said, well, maybe if one cardiovascular disease event equals two major bleeds, then, you know, 21% of women and 40% of men are likely to have a benefit. But those are sort of fuzzy numbers, fuzzy math. And, you know, I think one of the messages of our guidelines is say, let's work on the lifestyle first. Let's work on the blood pressure, work on the dietary and exercise habits. And if you use aspirin, that's going to come a lot later. So I'm going to skip ahead here. So you might say, so who might benefit from aspirin in primary prevention? Well, maybe those people who you know already have some clinical disease. So going back to, you know, a CT scanner, less than 1 millisievert, about the same as a bilateral mammogram. And, you know, those of you who haven't seen these images before, so this is the sternum, ribs, backbone here, and that calcification in the LAD and LAD diagonals, especially in a young person, is someone that would indicate that they're at a higher risk. So maybe someone who has a high percentile or high score for their age. And a study Mike Miedema led from Minneapolis was saying, well, if the number needed to harm is right here in terms of a major bleed, maybe aspirin would be beneficial in those people who you knew were at higher risk that had at least moderate coronary calcification. So that's a modeling study. It wasn't an actual clinical trial, but that's the way many of us think of things now. So who else might benefit from aspirin in primary prevention? Well, this is sort of beyond the guidelines, but you know, maybe some patients with HIV, they have increased risk of platelet dysfunction and immune activation. And so there's a REPRIEVE trial going on about statins and HIV that will probably come out soon. We don't really have one in with aspirin and HIV patients. Maybe some patients they might have with autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, psoriatic arthritis. We know that they're at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. You might think of aspirin in those people, but again, we really don't have the data. So what about all of those snowbirds coming down from Baltimore and New York and Boston to enjoy this beautiful weather that you guys get to live all the time in? We would say we avoid initiating in healthy older adults. Taking it doesn't seem to increase survival. Given the higher bleeding risk, it's difficult to justify its routine use. And if they're already on aspirin, many times we deprescribe. A lot of times patients like to be on less pills. Maybe you might compromise with them and say, oh, let's at least until the guidelines change again, maybe we'll go from daily aspirin to Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then we'll reevaluate again in a year. But that GI bleeding is one of the main causes of things that we are concerned about. So remember that aspirin is still strongly indicated for secondary prevention. And while there may be select middle-aged people who have a very high risk of ASCVD, most of your patients no longer need aspirin in primary prevention. So I still think about it in people who you can't get to stop smoking, maybe a strong family history of premature disease, maybe people who are intolerant to statins and you can't get their numbers down as well as you want, or you can't get their blood pressure down as well, people with advanced subclinical disease, a CAC score, a coronary calcium score greater than 100, and maybe some select patients with diabetes because there was a 12% relative risk reduction. And maybe you might say, well, maybe if I just give the aspirin 4 days a week instead of seven, have them take it with food in their stomach, you know, that's reasonable. But hopefully we'll have more data coming up. So Paul Ridker gave a really good quote. He said, thus, beyond diet maintenance, exercise, smoking cessation, the best strategy for the use of aspirin in primary prevention may simply be to prescribe a statin instead. We have so much more data about statin therapy, and it's much safer than aspirin in terms of you don't have to worry about that GI bleeding. I think a lot of patients don't really realize that. So another variation of that cartoon, to prevent a heart attack, take one aspirin a day, take it out for a jog, then take it to the gym, then take it for a bike ride. Those are the things in this beautiful Boca Raton weather that you want your patients to be doing more of. So we went through a lot about the A's. Now we're going to go in the home stretch and go through B through E. So blood pressure, what do you need to know? Well, tell your patients that normal isn't 140 over 90. It's not 135 over 87. It's actually less than 120 over 80. And elevated is 120 to 129. And stage 1 hypertension is actually 130 to 139 or 80 to 89. And most of our patients don't realize that. And they, you know, it wasn't too long ago when some of us were in medical school, our professors would tell us, you take 100 plus a person's age, and that's a decent blood pressure. So if you were 60 years of age, a systolic of 160 was fine. Well, the primary prevention guidelines say the first step, think non-pharmacologic, weight loss, dietary improvements, cut back on sodium, increase dietary potassium, increase the physical activity, and cut back on alcohol. Those are really the first steps when someone has high blood pressure, and also to have them do some home monitoring. Our guidelines say that if you're a high-risk individual, a ASCVD risk score at least 10%, have diabetes or chronic kidney disease, you might start thinking about medical therapy at 130 over 80. But if you're a low-risk individual, probably don't start thinking about medicines until it's 140 systolic or diastolic of 90. What do you need to know about C for cholesterol? Statin therapy, first line for primary prevention for people with super high LDLs, definitely. The guidelines said those with diabetes, middle age, give strong consideration to, and those who have a high enough ASCVD risk score. And when we had these sort of summary take-home message of the guidelines, we said if someone went to Boca Raton, had stenting or bypass surgery, you want to reduce the LDL with a high-intensity or moderately tolerated, maximally tolerated statin. And remember, the more you lower LDL, the greater the risk reduction. You want to try to get at least a 50% reduction. So for those very high-risk people, the people that went in here to Boca Raton and had a heart attack, have peripheral vascular disease procedures for clogged iliac arteries, they're very high risk. You want to try to get those LDL down below 70, and it's reasonable to add ezetimibe to maximally tolerated statin if the LDL remains above 70. And if they're still on maximally tolerated statin plus ezetimibe, still the LDL is above 70, then we might consider a PCSK9 inhibitor. But the cost effectiveness data is probably the best when the LDL is still 100 or higher for PCSK9 therapy. So what about severe primary hypercholesterolemia like familial hypercholesterolemia? LDL is at least 190. We now brought the numbers back. We say an LDL at least 100 on high-dose statin therapy. You might consider adding the ezetimibe to get that LDL down below 100. And then you still could consider a PCSK9 inhibitor, but we're still not sure about the long-time cost effectiveness. And we thought we had pretty good guidelines, U.S. guidelines. I was on the writing panel. But then the Europeans came out and made things even a little bit maybe simpler in some respects, but more complicated in others. So they say we should really be targeting a 50% reduction or an LDL less than 55. And they included a lot of people that we didn't include. They included people who may have moderate carotid disease or moderate coronary disease on a CT angiogram or a diagnostic cath, even if they've never had an event. They included people with severe chronic kidney disease, and they also included people with diabetes, multiple risk factors, or having even type 1 diabetes of 20 years, getting their LDLs down less than 55. The Europeans thought this made a lot of sense, you know, much lower LDL targets. But in reality, I think the problem with this is that, as a recent analysis just came up with, if you do that the European way, you're going to be using a lot more PCSK9 inhibitor therapy to get LDLs that low. And I just don't think the data is that strong. So how many of you ever prescribed high-dose EPA, icosapent ethyl? Anyone? A few. And I bet you your patients over the next few months are going to be asking you a lot about this key trial called REDUCE-IT. This wasn't in our American guidelines, but it was in the European guidelines. To get into REDUCE-IT, you needed to have established cardiovascular disease or diabetes with other risk factors. You needed to have a triglyceride between 150 and 500, and your LDL had to be less than 100. So well-treated people on statin therapy. And lo and behold, adding high-dose EPA led to a marked decrease in events. This is the U.S. Subgroup. Looks like, Gary, I don't know if someone's back there. We could get the slide back up. I have it here, but I just don't have it on the big screen. But this is always a great way for the speaker's blood pressure to go up a little bit and start sweating and things of that nature. That would be always a fun thing for the speaker. But what you need to remember is that having high dose, Gary, I have it on the screen here, but it's just not showing up here. All right, it's always good to have the professionals here. But remember, the over-the-counter fish oil capsules have not shown that benefit. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. But I think your patients are going to be reading much more about this, and the company Amarin that makes this medication is really engaged in a high volume public relations campaign. It's sort of the Michael Bloomberg approach of saturating all the journals and airwaves, TV, and everything. So think more about which patients you might consider for this. So next C is cigarettes. What our guidelines talked about is try to use both nicotine replacement and either bupropion or varenicline. Using that combination is better than either alone. And we still need to do a lot better job with smoking cessation, but that combination therapy is so very important. And realize that most people are not going to succeed in their first or second quit attempt, but we want to try to keep after people. And the guidelines said it's good to train, have some dedicated trained staff for tobacco treatment. And whether it's here at the medical center or in other practice or involving nurse practitioners, I think that's very helpful. And the guidelines also talk about avoiding secondhand smoke because that can have adverse effects. So we're in the home stretch, D for diet, nutrition. The advice is probably what your mom or your grandmother told you many years ago. Emphasize vegetables, fruits, legumes, things like beans, scallops, nuts, whole grains, and fish. Cut back on saturated fat and increase mono and polyunsaturated fats, and cut back on dietary cholesterol and sodium. Makes sense. Dr. Cohn did a great job on that last night at dinner. I have to give him some kudos for his dietary choices. So the guidelines also said minimize intake of processed meats. You might say, well, what's that, Roger? Well, things like bacon, sausage, deli meats. Cut back on those simple sugars, refined carbohydrates. Cut back on those sweetened beverages. Even diet soft drinks may also tend to stimulate the appetite, and having people tend to drink more water and less sodas is better. And minimize the trans fats, some that Mayor Bloomberg tried to tackle when he was in New York a while back. So what else do you need to know about diet? Well, guidelines say it's not just dietary changes. It's trying to get people in a comprehensive lifestyle program, trying to get people to eventually drop their total calories by at least 300 a day and then work up maybe to 500 a day and do some calorie counting maybe a few times a week. The guidelines also say it's also important to emphasize increasing physical activity. It may help rev up their metabolism and make them more physically fit. And also measure waist circumference, measure the BMI, and give people feedback on that. So I always take out a tape measure and check out a waist circumference. And I think that people realize that it must be important if the doctor is doing that at each and every visit. So for diabetes, what we call a DASH diet, Mediterranean or vegetarian and vegan, are the ones that have the greatest evidence base. We talked about referring people to a dietitian or nutritionist. We talked about a combination of aerobic and resistance exercise and a better glycemic goal. The AHA, ACC guidelines and the ADA guidelines said A1C less than 7%. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinology says if you can get that A1C down to 6.5% or less, push that lifestyle even more, and I think that's so very important. Another thing to keep in mind is our U.S. guidelines still have metformin as the first-line therapy. It's inexpensive. For some people, it dulls their appetite, leads to some modest weight loss. But the European guidelines recently came out, and the Endocrine Society guidelines came out, and they actually recommend an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And again, they're on the PGA and the NFL and Major League Baseball with a lot of ads for all of their products a lot. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Now, we gave that a 2B indication, so a lower level, partly because so far the only primary prevention study of individuals with a GLP-1 receptor agonist showed borderline 12% relative risk reduction. So you might say, well, who are the higher risk diabetic patients? Well, clearly those who've already had a cardiac event, clearly those who had target organ damage, like a low GFR, people with multiple risk factors, and maybe the people who have type 1 diabetes of long duration. And the European guidelines, I think, complement the U.S. guidelines very well. But as cardiologists, we'll need to work more closely with primary care and endocrinologists to get more comfort using some of these GLP-1 receptor agonists. The SGLT2 inhibitors or pills, one a day, cardiologists can handle that. We're not as comfortable with the injections. And then we're almost at the end here, spectrum of physical activity. So keep in mind you get the biggest bang for the buck when you go from being a couch potato to doing some regular walking. Higher exercise levels, the better. Remember that 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity is sort of a minimum. Ideally, if we can have patients like the ones you have here, enjoy that beautiful weather, get out, get 250, 300 minutes of moderate intensity activity a week. And most studies show you get a diminished additive benefit from doing things like 5Ks and 10Ks and marathons and things like that. But the more exercise you do, clearly the better. And then we went through that ABCDE approach. I'd like to add an F for heart failure. And keep in mind that one of the problems that we have as a profession is that we don't use the doses of medicines that are in clinical trials. So clearly this is a nice adaption of an article that Greg Fonero did, that first step for most of us an ACE or an ARB, and then a beta blocker. And then we might consider an aldosterone antagonist like spironolactone, or we have the decision tree of changing the ACE-ARB for an ARNI. And nowadays, we now have some good data with even FDA weighing in on this, supporting an SGLT2 inhibitor also decrease heart failure risk. So when a patient comes back to us, whether it's lipid-lowering therapy, whether it's blood pressure-lowering therapy, whether it's a person who has heart failure, think about, rather than just saying everything's fine, we'll keep things the way they are, you get more benefit if you get to the dosages that were used in the clinical trials. So as we wind up here, busy slide, but say assess risk, pooled cohort equation first. You can personalize the assessment. You can refine by coronary artery calcium. For people who have AFib, use that CHADS VAS score. It helps you determine who should be on an anticoagulant. For antiplatelet therapy, rethink aspirin. Maybe if they're smokers, maybe they have a high calcium score, maybe if they have a real high ASCVD risk score. Remember, if they've had a recent PCI, you're probably going to add that P2Y12 inhibitor. And anticoagulate with a NOAC or warfarin. For blood pressure, remember, 120 is the new 140. We used to be satisfied with 140. Now we say normal is less than 120 over 80. If you're a high-risk person, we'll start meds at 130 over 80. For cholesterol, you know, it's shared decision-making. You can, if a patient's reluctant to go on a statin, think about a coronary artery calcium scan. Cigarettes, remember, never too late to quit. Motivational interviewing. Use that combination of nicotine replacement plus a medicine like bupropion or varenicline. For diabetes, you want to screen for those high-risk individuals, especially the people long duration, albuminuria, low GFR. U.S. guidelines go metformin first and then one of the newer agents, and think about an ACE or an ARB first line for blood pressure in someone with diabetes. For your diet, you know, calculate the BMI and waist circumference. Emphasize vegetables, fruits, nuts, legumes, whole grains, fish. People need to know how many calories they're taking in. Weight Watchers uses a point system. It works for some, but I still think people need to know how many calories they take in because there are certain foods Weight Watchers doesn't assign any points to. And you can still eat too much of, quote, healthy items, and those calories are still too high. For exercise, a minimum of 150 minutes a week of moderate or 75 per minute of minutes of per week of vigorous. And remember, any moderate intensity physical activity is beneficial. For heart failure, all those medications we now have, and for people with low EF, you know, we consider an ICD or resynchronization therapy. So when I see a patient, this is, I think, my next to last slide, I use this sort of checkbox in my head, antiplatelet therapy, whether it's single antiplatelet agent like aspirin or dual antiplatelet therapy. They have AFib or DVT, you know, do they need anticoagulant therapy? B for a beta blocker if they're post-MI or people who have had congestive heart failure. Remember that blood pressure goal is less than 130 over 80. We talked a lot about cholesterol and cigarettes. D for diet and weight and diabetes management. E for exercise. And we have a lot of boxes that we could potentially check for heart failure. And I think you'll give your patient even better care if you keep that stuff in mind. So my last slide is this one. It gets back to a nice, a Hopkins Blue Jay with a lacrosse stick right here. B for blood pressure. We got B active here, the E for exercise, healthy blood cholesterol, healthy diet, normal weight, don't smoke, and normal blood sugar. That great Life Simple 7 is all we really need to do to come down here and hopefully spend many more great decades in the beautiful weather of Boca Raton, Florida. Thank you very much for your attention. Happy to take some questions. Thanks. Sure. Dr. Cohn wanted me to comment on how does the AHA usually say best way to measure waist circumference. So parallel to the floor, just at the top of the iliac crest, and that's where you measure it. You know, people say, well, I wear my pants way down here, doc. And we say, well, for the studies, you know, we're measuring at the top of the iliac crest. And most men, unfortunately, we tend to get extra weight in our midsection first, and that's very important. Is there a question in the back? Yes, sir.
Yes. Question regarding the aspirin trials. So, would there any secondary analysis controlling for statin use and look at the benefit of aspirin since the last three trials were having, step up of the statin use?
So, good question. So, the question relates to the use of statins and how that affected the aspirin trials. So, that's a good point. I think one of the things I tried to get across is that with the more recent trials, there's been a greater use of statins. And the analyses when they tried to look at statin users versus non-statin users, it really didn't make much difference other than the fact that statin users on the whole tended to be at lower risk if for the most part they had fewer events. Now, there are some people who were turned down on statin users to be at higher risk, and they were probably because they had pretty super high cholesterol levels at baseline. But when you look at all these factors, whether it was statin use or use of an ACE inhibitor or smoking versus non-smoking, it came out just about the same, and unfortunately it was sort of a neutral, that aspirin, at least in the modern era, doesn't seem to have as much benefit as we like. Though there was that 12% relative risk reduction in the diabetics, but counterbalanced by that increased risk of GI bleeding. So that's why I think it's still reasonable to say, well, you know, maybe I'll make sure rather than taking aspirin on an empty stomach, we'll take it with food in your stomach. Maybe if we know you have some carotid disease or mild to moderate coronary artery calcium, to have a patient stay on aspirin. But I try to really stress with them that the big drawback was the GI side effects. Yes, sir. Great question. So thank you for that. So the question is, what about carotid ultrasound? Is that just as good as a coronary artery calcium score? There's no radiation. And I think what the studies seem to show, in our multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis, coronary artery calcium, at least in the people who are age 40 and above, is a little bit better predictor than carotid ultrasound. It's not that much better. And I think, you know, for me, or Dr. Cohn, or many of the people in the audience, Dr. Rubin, et cetera, you know, if we have anyone that we know has some subclinical atherosclerosis, that's enough for us to say, I think, you know, being on statin therapy makes sense, and we're going to push you extra hard from a lifestyle point of view. I think where coronary calcium has a little advantage over carotid ultrasound is that if indeed you're a middle-aged individual and you have no coronary artery calcium, that's more reassuring in terms of lack of events over the next 10 to 15 years than not seeing any significant carotid plaque. But that's also, you know, very reasonable, and I know there's physicians in Florida and other places who, you know, will use the carotid ultrasound as a screening tool when they're on the fence about how aggressive to be. But thank you for that question. Other questions? Yes, sir. Great questions. So, yeah, thank you so much for that. So one of the issues with the PPIs or being on Pepcid, like an H2 blocker or things like that, is are we trading a potential modest benefit for other side effects? And, you know, there is some data, though, you know, not that strong, that long-term use of PPIs may have some other adverse effects, whether it's on bone mineral density or other things like that. And that's something that I don't really know. It's a good question. I don't know if there's a study going on right now that's incorporating that strategy. So I think, you know, if indeed, you know, a person is maybe at higher risk of GI irritation or things like that, it may make sense to say, you know, try low-dose omeprazole or something like that. I think it's pretty clear we would do that in someone who already has had stenting or carotid endarterectomy, and we want to keep them on antiplatelet therapy. But that's a great point, and thank you for that comment. I think right now we're not prepared to say, you know, we're going to have our patients stay on a PPI for decades if it's only a potential for a modest benefit with aspirin and primary prevention. But a great thought. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Just a short comment. Wonderful talk.
Yeah.
The problem is, I heard someone wise once tell me, well, the real money is in the fancy, new, expensive pharma drugs that are coming out. So you don't hear your talk often enough. And I think all of us have to take that primary care responsibility to see beyond the ads that are in the cardiology journal or GI journal or AMA that are fancy, glossy ads that these new expensive drugs and get back to things that may not be expensive but that are much more effective.
Thank you for your comment. I think one of the emphases of the primary prevention guidelines was just that, trying to get people to realize that not only can you lower the risk of a heart attack or stroke, but also heart failure and atrial fibrillation with much better lifestyle habits and much better control of one's, you know, blood pressure and cholesterol. So the back to the basics theme is something that we tried to get back to. And I think we always have to, especially in this day and age when there's, you know, a lot of different temptations about, you know, the more expensive therapies and what to do, we have to take into account cost. And, you know, the upcoming election, we'll be talking a lot about the cost of health care. But all of us, I think, whether we're cardiologists or primary care or endocrinology, has to keep that in mind. And one of the challenges, if you jump right to the SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 for, you know, having a A1C of 6.7 or 7.2%, is that that's a pretty high cost for the year. And we also have to remind patients that if they can make some of those sustained lifestyle improvements, then that's not a life sentence to being called a diabetic. So thanks for those comments. Any other questions, comments? Tell you about anything you need to know about college lacrosse, NFL football, anything of that nature. So why don't you guys enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you very much for your attention, and great to be here.